The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandi Spergata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is titled, Katie Couric Opens Up About Losing Her First Husband to Stage 4 Colon Cancer. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, but that's just one reason Katie Couric is encouraging people to take advantage of early detection screenings. In a new interview with Today, the journalist and founder of Katie Couric Media said she began advocating for screenings after her first husband, Jay Monahan, passed away from colon cancer in 1998. The bottom line is, early screening saves lives. Early detection saves lives, Couric said. Monahan was 41 when he developed stage 4 colon cancer and passed away just 1 year later. Couric previously told Health Day that after being doubled over with pain in his abdomen, Monahan learned his colon was completely blocked by a tumor. Jay never really had any symptoms of colon cancer other than being tired all the time, which we chalked up to a busy lifestyle, having young children, and his coast-to-coast trips providing legal analysis for NBC, she said. The American Cancer Society says that colorectal cancer often doesn't cause symptoms until it is grown or spread, which is why getting screened is so important. The ACS has recommended screening for those age 45 and older since 2018, and in October 2020, draft guidelines from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force also recommended that screening starts at age 45. Screening wouldn't have crossed our minds for Jay when he was diagnosed at 41, Couric said. My hope is that we figure out a way to do even broader screening and that we can save even more lives, but until then, people need to pay attention. A study published in the BMJ found that getting a colonoscopy, an exam that uses a long, flexible tube to check for abnormalities in the colon, was associated with a 67% reduction in the risk of death for any colorectal cancer. Colon cancer rates in adults under 50 have been rising since the mid-80s, the ACS says, and younger age groups have seen the sharpest increases. In fact, one 2017 study found that people younger than 55 are 58% more likely to be diagnosed with late-stage colorectal cancer than older people. This is largely due to delayed follow-up symptoms, sometimes for years, because cancer is typically not on the radar of young adults or their providers, the authors wrote. Couric famously underwent a colonoscopy on air during a Today Show segment in 2000 when she was 43. She also got his and hers colonoscopies in 2019 with her husband John Molnar, where she revealed on Instagram that her doctors removed two polyps during the procedure. A polyp is a growth in the colon that can sometimes become cancerous, the ACS says. These have the potential to develop into cancer, and that's why screening is so important, Couric wrote in an Instagram caption. Yeah, the prep isn't that fun, but it's a lot better than being diagnosed with colon cancer. Couric also highlighted that more research is needed to explain why Black adults are 20% more likely to get colorectal cancer and about 40% more likely to die from it than other groups. We need to diversify our clinical trial patients, she said. We need to study why people of color, Black people in particular, are having much higher incidence of rectal cancer. We are making a very concerted effort to widen our net and to make sure that underserved populations or people who don't have access to medical care are screened for colon cancer and that they are included in all cancer research. She also added that she's very concerned that people may be missing screenings due to the pandemic. We really have to make up for lost time, Couric said. As we come out of this pandemic, you need to talk to your doctor. You need to make an appointment. Although Couric lost her husband 2 decades ago, she continues to honor him by spreading awareness about colon cancer. You live on in your girls and in our hearts, she wrote in a January 2020 Instagram post. We love you and miss you every day. Our next article is titled, How Oprah and Gail's 45-Year Friendship Began and Why It's Lasted. We may be a little bit biased here at O, But Oprah and Gail are our absolute favorite celebrity best friends. The pair's close-knit relationship is legendary, with fans often dubbing their own besties the Gail to their Oprah and vice versa. The women themselves even marvel at their story. While Oprah grew up impoverished, often moving between her parents' homes in Nashville and Milwaukee, Gail spent part of her childhood in Turkey, where she had a housekeeper and a swimming pool. But despite their vastly different upbringings, the women found one another and never looked back. Something about this relationship feels otherworldly to me, like it was designed by a power and a hand greater than my own, Oprah said in the August 2006 issue of O, the Oprah magazine. Whatever this friendship is, it's been a very fun ride, and we've taken it together. To celebrate these forever friends, we've put together a timeline of some of Gail and Oprah's standout moments, from their initial meeting in the 1970s to how they reunited in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. 1976, Oprah and Gail first meet as young journalists. They were 20-somethings in the early days of their careers, both employed at Baltimore's WJZ station. Oprah, now 67, was an anchor for the 6 o'clock news, and Gail, now 66, was a production assistant. Despite working in different departments, both were around the same age and single young black women. The two struck up an immediate bond. In the August 2006 issue of O, the Oprah magazine, the two recounted their friendship origin story. Lady O invited Gail to stay with her for the night after Gail couldn't make it home during a snowstorm. And as they say, the rest is history. We became friends that first night because for the first time I met somebody who I felt was like me, Gail said. I'd never met anybody like that. Certainly not another black girl. I grew up in an all-white community. The two explained that both of them could relate to the fact that even their musical tastes put them at odds with peers. Gail loved Barry Manilow, and Oprah was a fan of Neil Diamond. It's that whole being the odd girl out thing. We didn't fit into everybody else's perception of what it's like to be a black girl, Oprah said. Gail added, but we still had a very strong sense of being black and were very proud of being black. So to meet another black girl like that was wow. 1986, Gail makes her first appearance on The Oprah Winfrey Show. During the debut season of the iconic The Oprah Winfrey Show, Gail made her first of many guest cameos over the years. Apparently, the episode's topic was about celebrities and their best friends, and the duo spent the show entertaining each other by recounting stories about ill-fitting dresses and disastrous hairdos. 1994, Gail surprises Oprah for her 40th birthday. In one of our favorite moments from the Oprah Winfrey Show archives, Gail pulled off the ultimate surprise by unexpectedly popping in on Oprah in the middle of an episode. For an on-air party for her milestone birthday, celebrity guests like Gladys Knight, Felicia Rashad, Aretha Franklin, and Patti LaBelle were all in attendance talking about how they lived their best lives in their 40s. But just as Knight was providing some wisdom, a clearly shocked Oprah interrupted to make a special announcement. "Gail is here," she exclaimed. The two embraced, and through tears, she explained why exactly her bestie's appearance was so welcome. "This is so touching to me because Patti was here and Aretha came, and then everyone was coming, and I thought, gee, I wish Gail could be here to see this," she said. Gail was equally grateful to be in attendance, offering the most humble response. "I have no song to sing," King said. "I have no words of wisdom. I just wanted to be here with you today." 2004, Gail and Oprah throw it back to colonial times on The Oprah Winfrey Show. For the ultimate exercise in stepping out of their comfort zones, the duo visited a family in Maine for the PBS series Colonial House, where people live like it's 1628. Yes, voluntarily. It would become one of the show's most unforgettable segments. With no technology, running water, or electricity, Oprah and Gail set out to spend a weekend as the colonials did, traditional garb and all. The two made a valiant attempt to survive the experience, participating in a bonfire dance in lieu of more modern entertainment. Oprah even recalled Gail's hilarious moves, bursting into laughter as she told the story. Her partner threw her down and she falls to the ground, Oprah said through giggles. She forgets to make the turn. Flung her a little too far there, fella. Later on, the friends bonded with their host family as the group all worked together to cook dinner and bake a cake. It was an experience Oprah called one of the most special meals she'd ever had, as it reminded her of her childhood. However, it wasn't quite enough to convince them to live the colonial life. The whole idea of this experience was that we were going to spend the weekend with all of these lovely people, Oprah said. After Gail got thrown down in the square dancing episode the night before, the guy went do-si-do and she went down. We decided to leave a little early. Well, at least they tried. 2006, our resident bestie set out on a grand cross-country road trip. In a fan-favorite Oprah Winfrey Show episode, Oprah and Gail escaped on the ultimate road trip. Dubbed See the USA in a Chevrolet, the two set out on a 10-day, 3,600-mile adventure from Santa Barbara to New York City. In one exceptional clip from day two, they had been driving for hours in Arizona and the close quarters were getting to them. All you had to do today was listen to my singing, which should have been very pleasurable, Gail said, as Oprah complained about the trip. That's why I'm so damn cranky, Oprah countered. That's when the CBS This Morning host shot back with a little sass. I've been driving for 6 hours. All she's had to do is sit here and relax, and she's bitching. See, even Oprah and Gail have fights. The mood lightened considerably hours later when the two women found themselves rooms at a motel with 55-year-old teepees. During the trip, they also played bingo, met some cowboys, and even crashed a wedding. To sum it all up in one word, epic. 2018, Oprah and Gail support each other at career-defining moments. Both media legends in their own right, Oprah is a billionaire business mogul and Gail is an Emmy-winning journalist and member of the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame, each of these BFFs had a banner year in 2018. First up was Lady O in January. With words heard around the world, she accepted her Cecil B. DeMille Award at the Golden Globes with a roaring speech that sparked hashtag Oprah 2020 presidential race rumors. Along with Oprah's partner Stedman, Gail was also Oprah's date that night. Oprah even took to Instagram to show us a glimpse of their glam session in which she poked fun at her friend's lack of moisturizer. Get your elbows, she told Gail. Hey, a little Ash Wednesday on the elbows there. In June, for a segment on CBS This Morning, Gail joined Oprah for a first peek at Lady O's new exhibit at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which showcased Oprah's monumental life and career. Seeing everything under one roof brought tears to my eyes. Thanks, Lonnie Bunch, for giving @GailKing and I a sneak peek of watching Oprah. It's surreal. Exhibit is open tomorrow, she wrote in an Instagram caption. And 4 months later, the tables were turned when Gail took the spotlight as she was officially inducted into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame. Oprah presented her friend the award at the ceremony with a heartfelt toast. She deserves to be celebrated, not just for her news acumen, but for being her consistently joyful, vibrant, best outlook on life, best outlook on everybody's self, Oprah said. We are here tonight to celebrate you for continuing to build a legacy in the space of nice. We are here to honor your curiosity. We are here to honor your inquisitive interest in all of humankind. We're here to honor your desire to know the truth. January 2019, the OG Chronicles is born. In a move that was long overdue for the dynamic duo, a joint video series was officially launched on OprahMag.com called The OG Chronicles, starring Oprah and Gail. For the show, the two share the small screen as they dish out advice for their fans. As they comment on love lives and friendships, we're also treated to some super fun personal stories from the BFFs. In the first episode, we learn that Gail wants Don Saran wrap and a trench coat to spice up a relationship, while Oprah cooks soul food to keep it romantic with Stedman. I made some cornbread yesterday, and you would have thought I stripped myself butt naked, she revealed. One thing that's obvious, we'll never get tired of these women and their long-lasting friendship. It's clear that they have a bond like nothing else, and it's beautiful to see. So what's their secret? When we first met, Gail was always very happy with her life, Oprah told OprahMag.com, and therefore happiest for my life. You cannot have a friend that's unhappy with their life be happy with your life. You've got to have happiness to give happiness to other people. March 2019, Oprah praises Gail for her contentious R. Kelly interview. Following Lifetime's explosive Surviving R. Kelly documentary, the disgraced artist sat down with Gail in his first interview since he was arrested in Chicago on 10 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse. The explosive segment garnered Gail widespread praise as she kept her cool while Kelly proceeded to lose his. And one person who was in her corner during her glowing show of professionalism? Her bestie, Oprah, of course. Bravo at Gail King for calm and steady focus during hashtag R. Kelly interview. Outstanding job. Tell at CBS this morning we went to see the whole thing, Winfrey tweeted. April 2019, Oprah recognizes Gail's Big Time magazine honor. Just over a month later, Gail's hard work was put on display again when she was named one of the Time's 100 Most Influential People of 2019. It feels surreal and wonderful to not only be included, but to make one of the covers, the honoree wrote on Instagram. And it should come as no surprise that Lady O was right there to support her again, just as they always have done in the past 45 years. So proud of you at Gail King and you at Ava for capturing the spirit of her in your words. Hashtag time 100. So simple, but oh so sweet. March 2020, Oprah interviews Gail for the first time. In Denver, Colorado, during the last leg of Oprah's WW 2020 Vision Tour, Gail was interviewed by Oprah for the first time ever in their decades-long friendship. The two covered a lot of ground during their conversation, including the story of how they first met, which we detailed above, Gail's divorce, and internet trolls. But they ended on a sentimental note about their friendship. The secret to me is trust. I trust you totally, even if I disagree with you. I still trust you, Gail said. I have this joke with Oprah where people say, I found my best friend with my husband. I say to Oprah, if you ever walked in and caught me with Stedman, you shouldn't be mad. You should take me to the mental institution. Don't be mad. I need help. But, I mean, we're honest with each other and trust each other and actually are very like-minded. June 2020, Oprah and Gail reunite after quarantining separately. After months of living on opposite coasts, Gail in New York and Oprah in California, Gail joined Oprah at her Santa Barbara home for a socially distanced lunch. In the days following, Oprah proved to be an excellent host, delivering ice cream to Gail's doorstep, who was staying in her guest house. But after quarantining for 13 days, Oprah and Gail finally reunited with a hug after the latter tested negative for COVID-19. Our next article is titled, These New Jersey Residents Are Getting Vaccine Appointments with a Little Help from Strangers. In the before times, Maria Cook was known as the friend who could nab in-demand concert tickets. Now Cook, a mother of two and her family's primary breadwinner, is applying her digital savvy to New Jersey's complicated COVID-19 vaccine scheduling system, where she makes appointments for seniors in need. I don't sleep much, Cook 36 tells OprahMag.com. I've been up until 1:30 in the morning for strangers. I need to do this. Cook's motivation to help is clear and urgent. Her father, Louis Quesada, died from COVID-19 last October at the age of 70. After months of lockdown in New Jersey, Quesada and Cook's mother finally decided to move home to their native Costa Rica. Symptoms manifested during his mandated quarantine period. He was gone within a week. I see my father in their faces, Cook says of the senior citizens she now helps. I want to pay it forward so that nobody has to go through what I go through. It's horrible, she adds. Since I cannot do this for my dad, since I cannot protect him, what better way to do it than protect others? It feels like the Hunger Games, every man for himself. Cook finds seniors through the New Jersey COVID Vaccine Info Facebook page, which has become a central hub for navigating the state's rollout and its hurdles. Many of the page's 64,000 members have been languishing on sites' waiting lists or haven't been able to schedule online appointments at all. Cook FaceTimes with the individuals so they know I'm real, enters their necessary information into an Excel spreadsheet, and loads up sites that work based on their location. Then she proceeds to refresh sites for hours at a time. In New Jersey, the most densely populated state in the country, people 65 and over or under 65 with pre-existing conditions are eligible to make appointments at a variety of outlets, including hospitals, local clinics, ShopRite, CVS, Rite Aid, and six mega sites spread throughout the state. The vast majority of New Jersey's appointments are found online, with the University Hospital in Newark being one of the state's few vaccination sites to book exclusively through a call center and email. In January, the state set up a vaccine call center, but its overworked agents were unable to make appointments. That means people are left to navigate a slew of individual websites with appointment openings dropping at random hours and vanishing quickly. Some sites operate on a waitlist basis, with the individuals contacted once their number is up. You buy shampoo and vitamins in two clicks, but to get a life-saving vaccine, you need to fill out four pages of forms, only to be told computer says no, one Facebook user wrote, referencing the common experience of completing the form only to be informed appointments are gone. Further confusion was spurred in January when New Jersey's official vaccine scheduling system launched. People pre-registered through the state's online portal, believing that would be sufficient to secure an appointment. In fact, many vaccine centers did not use New Jersey's vaccine scheduling system and could be scheduled individually. This system, compounded with a vaccine supply problem that Governor Phil Murphy acknowledged, has led to a sluggish vaccine rollout that ironically requires speed to navigate. It's survival of the quickest. It's hard and time-consuming. I know some older people who said, forget it, I give up, I'll just wait, Kate Plessing Brunetto, who has made 42 appointments for people in her parents' social circle, says. Plessing Brunetto's trick is downloading an auto-refresher and sitting in front of her browser for hours each evening. After visiting countless websites, Eileen Halsh, 65, and her husband had given up until they were connected via a mutual friend with Plessing Brunetto. 15 minutes later, Plessing Brunetto had set the Halshes up with appointments and resources. I was in shock. I thought, this is an angel you're meeting along your path, Halsh says. Cook and Plessing Brunetto have mastered the appointment-making skills that the New Jersey COVID Vaccine Info Facebook group's members have gathered to teach each other. The feed is populated by exclamation-filled announcements of appointment availability, helpful tips like setting alerts for Twitter bots that notify you when appointments are up for grabs, and triumphant selfies from the vaccine line. Some people simply use the group to vent their frustration. After making it through a pandemic year, they're unable to cross the finish line simply because they can't refresh pages fast enough. Many of the people who need the vaccines the most are often the ones who are unable to procure them. If the priority group was seniors, and not every senior has internet access or a computer or the skills, why are appointments almost all online? Why not one simple form and then someone will call you? Why does it have to be like this where you are fighting, Plessing Brunetto asks. The Facebook community offers relief. If you look at the comments of posts where someone is frustrated, it's a lot of people saying, private message me, I'll help you, says Brandy Prell, 27, who formed the Facebook group with her sister, Brittany Prell Cohen, 33. The sisters, both educators for the deaf and hard of hearing, were inspired to create the Facebook group after booking their grandmother in Florida an appointment thanks to information gleaned from another vaccine-focused Facebook page. After, Cohen received calls from her grandmother's friends asking for help. There was a need. All these older people had no idea where to go, Cohen recalls. She realized the problem would be similar in New Jersey, where she lives. I said, Brandy, we need to start this in New Jersey. It's going to be impossible once things open up here. So that's what we did. Her prediction was right. Soon after forming, the group exploded in size. The sisters and a cadre of moderators now spend their days connecting people with information, and in some cases, connecting people with actual vaccines. It restores your faith in humanity, Plessings Brunetto says of the kindness demonstrated in the New Jersey COVID Vaccine Info Facebook group. Cook is hardly the only person reaching out to strangers. I had an 83-year-old woman reach out to me yesterday, sharp as a tack. She called me and said, "I cannot begin to thank you," Julie Cruz-Rock, a member of the Facebook group and an attorney and mother of two, says. Since she started making appointments for strangers, she's received handwritten cards and homemade cakes from grateful seniors. It's completely unnecessary. This work is so rewarding. Even after making 80 appointments, Cruz-Rock 42 still likens the ordeal to a video game. "The whole process from appointment to confirmation has my blood pumping," Cruz-Rock says. "Seeing an appointment pop up is not sufficient to know you got it. It's a challenge between seeing it and securing it," she says. "It's become a game to me," adds Stacy Sapoznik, who is also balancing motherhood and a full-time job. "You should see me in the evenings. I'm stationed up with my laptop open, bookmarked to all the sites I've had success in. My husband thinks I'm out of my mind." Cruz-Rock and Sapoznik are now self-professed vaccine matchmakers, connecting seniors in New Jersey with appointments through W Girls, a nonprofit helping underprivileged women founded by Amy Heller. Heller recruited volunteers through the New Jersey COVID Vaccine Info Facebook group, tapping people like Sapoznik and Cruz-Rock, who were already lending their services to those in need. All of the matchmakers are women, and many of them are working mothers like herself. You'd think it would be people who don't have much going on. It's actually people with children and jobs who are doing this. We're determined to make this easier for the most vulnerable people in our community. We're talking about people in our backyard, she says. A management consultant and volunteer coordinator, Heller decided to build a more formal system to connect volunteers with people in need after she spent a weekend helping a 96-year-old woman she met on the New Jersey COVID Vaccine Info Facebook group in February. Now, instead of posting on the group, people can fill out a form on the W Girls website. The system is not set up for seniors. They want to be independent, and they are, but at 96, do you want to be following 15 sites and learning tricks like putting in zeros for your Social Security number? No, Heller says. There has to be a better way to do this. Now Heller has 200 volunteers working on 2,000 requests and counting. W Girls booked 525 appointments in the initiative's first 5 days and is on track to book 1,000 by the end of February. These people are literally housebound. Securing them a vaccine will give them their freedom back and give them hope, Heller says. One 85-year-old woman with pre-existing conditions wrote to Heller to thank her organization. "I am so relieved mentally. The stress and frustration are debilitating. I can breathe," she wrote. Heller is planning to expand the volunteer outreach to urban communities in New Jersey that have been hit hard by the virus. The state's four largest cities, Newark, Jersey City, Paterson, and Elizabeth, saw the greatest numbers of excess deaths in 2020. "We're pivoting to more vulnerable populations, vaccine-adverse populations," she says. Reflecting on the outpouring of volunteer support, Heller is reminded of her annual prom dress donation drive, W Girls' most popular charity event. "Just as everyone has prom memories, everyone unfortunately has COVID memories. You know, the fear that you've harbored for your loved ones and your family. The ability to take that away for someone else is really fulfilling," she says. For people seeking to help in their community, Heller recommends connecting with local senior centers, looking out on social media for volunteer groups to join, and checking on their neighbors. "There isn't a single person in the New Jersey COVID Vaccine Info Facebook group that hasn't somehow been touched by the virus." For Prell Cohen, whose 90-year-old grandma survived the coronavirus last March, the collective experience inspires altruism. "I can relate that story to the 98-year-old woman that posted the other day saying she needs a vaccine. I don't want her family to go through something tragic," she says. Some, like Cook, have experienced tragedy and continue anyway. I think my dad would be so proud, she says of her work. My dad was a fantastic person. Above all, the volunteers are most motivated by the return of reunions and independence after a year of social isolation. Sapoznik thinks of the man she assisted recently who thanked her on behalf of his 7 grandchildren. I believe I'm giving these people an opportunity to live their lives again. Our next article is titled, Exactly How to Say No Without Feeling Guilty. If you've ever forced yourself to attend yet another event you didn't want to go to, accepted a date with someone you weren't interested in, or embarked on another project you didn't have the bandwidth for, chances are you haven't learned how to say no. Politely refusing a situation isn't easy, especially when you're uninterested in managing the PTA bake sale, welcoming unruly guests into your home, or turning down a request from a friend you haven't seen in a while. And establishing boundaries is even tougher if you have to deny a request made by loved ones or a superior at work. But of course, it is possible to learn how to say no without feeling guilty. It just takes a bit of skill. According to psychologists and husband and wife duo Eric Hazeltine, PhD, and Chris Gilbert, PhD, doing so begins by shifting your perspective. We value ourselves more when we believe we're assertive and creative, which makes others value us more in return, Hazeltine says. Translation: sometimes in the long run, saying no without being rude actually earns you more respect than a yes does. Learning to say no starts with paying attention to your body. Gilbert, whose research explores the ways stress and anxiety manifest physically, emphasizes the importance of being in tune with your body's reaction when an ask comes your way. If the body is rebelling, there's an indication that you've said yes too much, she says. Look out for tense muscles, stomach pain, fatigue, and a scratchy throat. Signs that saying no may be what's right. Take your time before turning down a request. Don't give in to that natural knee-jerk inclination to say yes, advises Julianne Worm, a learning specialist and author of Working in the Regio Way. Instead, mull over the ask by saying, you'll think about it, or I can have a response to you in 24 hours. It's easier to politely decline the next day. Even if you can bite the inside of your cheek for 30 seconds, it'll give you a moment to think and offer a boilerplate response you have prepared for these situations, Worm says. Consider putting it in an email. If saying no verbally is a challenge, you may be able to craft a more cordial response in writing. An email is a solid workaround. Sometimes being polite means finding a different way to say no. By getting into the rhythm of declining small tasks more regularly, you'll get used to understanding where your boundaries begin. A respectful way of uttering no? I really appreciate your offer, but it's not going to work for me. Your comfort level will increase over time. Remember, refusing someone isn't personal. Always keep your responses lighthearted and decline with a line that isn't specific to your relationship with the person. You're not hurting people's feelings, Worm says. In professional situations, don't be afraid to ask for help. This one is specific to work relationships. If you're fielding requests from left to right, tell your manager it's overwhelming and put the onus on them to delegate tasks to other people on your team. Coming up with another solution is often the nicest approach. Gilbert and Hazeltine suggest offering an answer to your no. Take this example. If family members request to extend their stay at your home, rather than harshly shut down the idea, ask how you can help them find more suitable accommodations. Instead of thinking of situations as all or nothing, meet in the middle. You can change your mind and still feel good about it. If you were caught off guard and accidentally agree to something like planning a friend's bridal shower, you can circle back and decline. By doing so within a few days or less, you can explain that you responded out of haste and have realized you can no longer commit to their ask. Our next article is titled, The Secret to Getting More Done, A Productive Morning Routine. Think that having a morning routine that'll set you up for a productive day means meditating, running several miles, and reading the newspaper all before 8 o'clock? Think again. At the most basic level, a morning routine is anything you do most mornings, says Laura Vanderkam, a time management expert and author of Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. Chances are you already have one, and if you're like most people, it probably consists of waking up, having breakfast, getting dressed, brushing your teeth, getting your kids off to school, and heading to work. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best one, especially if it feels more crazed than calm. Your morning sets the stage for the rest of your day, says Benjamin Spall, author of My Morning Routine, How Successful People Start Every Day Inspired. A strong routine can lead to increased productivity, decrease anxiety, and create an overall sense that you are living life on your own terms. So what is the best way to start the day to ensure success? While there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach, experts agree that one of the most beneficial ways to make the most of your morning is by carving out time for activities that leave you feeling relaxed, energized, and motivated. Whether that's a 30-minute yoga class, writing in your journal, reading a book, solving a crossword puzzle, or working on a hobby. In fact, the quiet hours of the morning may be the ideal time to focus on these activities because not only are you likely to have more energy, but you're also less likely to be interrupted by kids, employees, and bosses, says Vanderkam. Now, we know what you're thinking. You want me to add more to my morning routine? Well, yes. Ahead, we'll show you exactly how to make new morning habits and share tips and ideas for tweaking your current routine so that you have a better day ahead. Firstly, find out how long your routine actually takes. If you want to manage your time better, you first need to know how you're spending it. In general, we are bad at judging time, says Vanderkam. You might think you can get up and do a half-hour workout in 30 minutes, but you can't. You have to put your contacts in, change into your workout clothes, and grab water, so it ends up taking longer than you think. To find out how long things really take, write down everything you do in 15 or 30-minute blocks for at least 1 week. A week is really the cycle of life as people actually live it, she says. Tuesday and Saturday both have the same number of hours and occur just as often, but our lives look very different on those days. If you can't track a full week, do at least 2 weekdays as well as Saturday or Sunday. You can also download the free app A-Tracker, which makes it easy to log your time and produces pie charts breaking down the data. Many people believe they have no free time whatsoever, says Vanderkam. When they track their time, they'll see that's not the case. Chances are your results will show you have some free time in your day, and if you adjust a few factors, more free time can be found in the morning. One example, most people have free time at night, but they use it to scroll the web or watch TV. If you cut that off just 30 minutes sooner, you could go to bed earlier, wake up earlier, and have this morning time that you could use for whatever energizes you, Vanderkam says. The second suggestion is figure out what your morning routine is missing. Consider this question. What would you like to spend more time doing? Your morning routine is personal to you, so how you choose to spend it should be a reflection of your values, says Spall. If you value your health, you may want to dedicate some time to working out or to making a healthy breakfast. If you value your mental health, you may want to meditate instead. Plus, the truth is, you probably won't get out of bed consistently for something you don't want to do. It's one of the biggest mistakes people make when planning a morning routine, says Vanderkam. If you don't want to run, you will not get up early to run. If you don't want to write, you're not going to get up and write. In a study published in the Journal of Behavioral Medicine, researchers looked at the exercise habits among college students. Those who enjoyed working out did so more often and reported that it was more habitual, whereas students who exercised just as frequently, but mostly out of guilt or to satisfy others, failed to form a robust habit. That enjoyment is essential, says Wendy Wood, PhD, Provost Professor of Psychology and Business at the University of Southern California, and author of Good Habits, Bad Habits. When we experience good feelings, our brain releases dopamine, which brings together information and memory that helps create a habit. Additionally, you might want to consider whether this is something that could realistically happen at any other point during the day. Mornings are particularly good for things that are important to you, but that life has a way of crowding out, says Vanderkam. For example, consider taking care of your plants or working on some creative writing. Could you find time after work to water your succulents? Absolutely. Could you find time after work to write 1,000 words? Probably not. At that point, you don't have a ton of energy and you may still be dealing with things that came up throughout the day, says Vanderkam. So that's the type of thing that's better to make time for in the morning. Here are some more ideas for what you might want to add to your morning routine. Stream a workout video. One of the few upsides to the coronavirus pandemic is that more fitness studios and instructors are now offering streaming and on-demand workout classes. Journal. You could describe your dreams or the last thing that made you smile in a special notebook, or you could do your morning pages, a concept popularized by author Julia Cameron, in which you write 3 pages by hand about whatever comes to mind. Another option, you could jot down 3 to 5 things you're grateful for, which has been scientifically shown to increase your happiness. Spend time on a hobby. If life keeps getting in the way of playing the piano, creating scrapbooks, writing short stories, or finally finishing the blanket you've been knitting for months, try doing them in the morning when you don't have to worry about a bunch of demanding last-minute tasks cropping up. Added bonus, you may also experience better work performance, improved physical health, and less stress. Go for a walk. Another mood-boosting strategy backed by research, spending time in nature. A 2019 study found that devoting 120 minutes a week, or just over 17 minutes a day, strolling a tree-lined creek or walking in the woods, greatly enhances a person's overall sense of well-being. Meditate. If your thoughts constantly jump from work deadlines to monthly bills to items on your to-do list, consider meditation, which has been shown to increase positive emotion as well as decrease stress and anxiety. Read a book. Do you struggle to keep your eyes open while reading before bed? Instead, try picking up a book first thing in the morning. Take an online class. Whether you're considering a career change, looking to pick up a new skill, or just love learning, there are plenty of online courses available right now. For classes from the top universities in the world, check out edX, a nonprofit platform founded by MIT and Harvard, or Coursera, a platform founded by Stanford professors. Spend quality time with your kids. Between making dinner, finishing homework, and getting ready for bed, it can be hard to fit quality family time in your evening routine. Instead, try devoting 30 minutes each morning to working on a craft project or reading books together. The one thing that Vanderkam and Spall emphasize you should not make time for in the morning is work emails. Yes, you need to return routine work emails, but it doesn't have to happen first thing in the morning because you can do it at other points in the day, like in between meetings, says Vanderkam. You're better off preserving the morning for stuff that's really important and can't be done at any other time. Another suggestion is start making changes to your routine slowly. We tend to get hung up on these articles of people who are doing incredible things before breakfast, says Vanderkam. But that can be really intimidating, not to mention unrealistic, if you are also trying to get your kids up and get yourself to work. Even if you have 2 or 3 things you want to add to your routine, start with the one you're most excited about or the one that's easiest to complete. We learn simple behaviors faster than more complex ones, says Wood. That means activities with multiple components like going to the gym, which involves getting up, getting dressed, driving there, signing in, putting your belongings in a locker, and working out, will take longer to become a habit. Another thing to keep in mind, you don't have to do something every single day for it to become part of your morning routine. When it comes to building a habit, consistency is key, says Wood. It's more important to do something on the same days at the same time and structured in a similar way than to do something 7 days a week. To ensure that you don't go from 0 to 100 and back to 0 again, Vanderkam recommends setting aside 45 minutes 4 times a week to start. If that's going well, you can also try adding a different activity to the 3 remaining days. That way, you could find the space for two things you want to do without feeling overwhelmed, she says. Another suggestion is to remove barriers that make it easy to not follow through on your habits. According to Wood, habits are mental shortcuts that allow us to repeat the same behavior that we've done in the past. Habit formation works a lot like learning math, she says in Good Habits, Bad Habits. When most of us first learn to compute 2 plus 2, we get the answer by totaling up 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1. But after some homework, we no longer need to do the computations and instead retrieve the answer directly from memory. Ultimately, forming a new habit comes down to three components: context, repetition, and reward. Think of context as everything around you, the time, day of week, location, or the environment in which your habit occurs. To understand the importance of context, consider chefs in professional kitchens, says Wood. Chefs don't start cooking until everything is literally in place. Their implements at the ready, ingredients measured and chopped, and items ordered as they are used in the recipe. Like chefs, we can organize our environment by removing barriers that make it easy to not follow through on our habits. To do this, think about what you can do to prep the night before. If you want to jog a few days a week, lay out your workout clothes before bed so you can get out the door quicker. If you want to do an art project with your kids a few times a week, make sure you've set up your supplies and packed lunches. Most important, make sure to consider proximity. In 2017, using cell phone records from 7.5 million devices, a data analytics company found that people who traveled a median distance of 3.7 miles to the gym went at least five times per month, while those who traveled an average of 5.1 miles went to the gym monthly. That seemingly small difference, less than a mile and a half, separated those who had an exercise habit and those who went rarely, Wood says in her book. If you want to read every morning, you might find it helpful to keep your book on your bedside table. If you want to learn a new skill, you might want to consider a self-paced online course instead of in-person lessons. If you want to complete a knitting project, try leaving it on your couch or kitchen counter rather than tucked away in a closet. Stick with your new routine and you'll reap the rewards. The bad news? Despite what you might have heard, there's no magic number when it comes to establishing habits. In fact, one study from 2009 found that drinking something healthy took 59 days of repetition to become largely habitual, while exercise required 91 days. The good news? Not only does repetition make activities seem easier, but studies have also shown you can miss a day or two without derailing your emerging habit. If you're having trouble early on, don't underestimate the power of rewarding yourself. Keep in mind, though, we're not talking about treating yourself to a donut after a strenuous workout or buying a nice purse to mark the fact that you did something for 30 days. Dopamine works for about a minute, tying together the context that you're in and the response that you gave in order to get that reward in memory, Wood says. So rewards need to happen simultaneously with the behavior. That said, the most effective rewards are often intrinsic to a behavior, like the feeling of pleasure you experience while curling up with a good book, or the pride you feel when you know the answer to a challenging crossword clue. But rewards can also be extrinsic, as long as they are immediate. Even though I'm quite addicted to my elliptical, I find it really boring, says Wood. So to make the experience more fun and enjoyable, I watch competitive cooking shows while I'm on it. Lastly, they suggest be flexible with your morning routine. If after a few weeks your morning routine still isn't coming together, or if a major life change like the coronavirus pandemic disrupts your routine, you might want to take a step back. Ask yourself, are there days that it didn't happen? If so, why didn't it happen? Says Vanderkam. If you can figure that out, then you can brainstorm a solution to the problem and tweak accordingly. Our next article is titled, Elizabeth Gilbert Admits, I Need a Dose of Courage Every Day. Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love, a chronicle of her post-divorce adventures in Italy, India, and Bali, became an iconic travel memoir not for its incredible scenes, transcendent experiences, and fascinating characters, although it has all of those things, but because the story began in a place where many of her readers have found themselves, kneeling on the bathroom floor in crisis. Gilbert's account of making peace with the past and discovering her more authentic self gave women an example of another kind of hero's journey, one in which the treasure at the end of the quest is a more truthful life. Eat, Pray, Love fans have told Gilbert that the book inspired them to begin or end romances, to change their job or their address or their beliefs. These radical shifts, she says, like any profound transformation, don't necessarily have anything to do with planes, trains, or automobiles. I have a painting of Emily Dickinson, who spent much of her life in her bedroom, but still created some of the most monumental poetry ever written, she says. That painting reminds me that the answers to my life are not likely to be found out there. The world is an enchanting place, but there are worlds inside us, too, that are always ready to be unlocked. In her subsequent books, such as Big Magic, A How-To for Cultivating Creative Expression, and The Signature of All Things, the story of the fictional 19th century botanist Alma Whitaker, Gilbert has remained an intrepid explorer of intellectual and emotional terrain. She's also spent the past few years navigating challenging personal territory, caring for and then grieving her partner, Raya Elias, who died of cancer in January 2018. "I can't live without her, so I don't," Gilbert says. "Sometimes I make a recording into my phone and just talk to her. The fact that the message is being recorded makes me feel like she's receiving it." Despite Gilbert's trademark blend of lightness and earnestness, common sense and magical realism, she says her equanimity doesn't come easily. "I need a dose of courage every day because I'm frightened every day. There will always be a nervous little person inside me. But if there's a creative project I'm afraid to attempt, a truth I need to tell, or a painful new reality I must face, I ask myself, what's the alternative?" Below, Gilbert answers 20 questions from O. Question number one, what's your no-fail, go-for-it motivational song? "Get Up Off of That Thing" by James Brown. When James Brown tells you to get up, you best get up. Question number two, what's most important for your mental health? "Every day I write myself a letter from love, divine, unconditional love. I ask for advice, and love always gives me kind answers, which I write down as they come to me. Even in my darkest hours, love has always shown up, saying, 'I'm right here, I've got you, you're never alone.'" Question number three, what is the physical challenge that scares you most? "Anything that involves getting in the path of powerful ocean waves." Question number four, what's the one mystery that you'd most love to solve? "How much control do we humans have over our behavior and personality? Can we change our nature? Or are we all just victims of our brain chemistry, genetics, hormones, and upbringing?" Question number five, who is your hero? "Sister Mary Scullion of Project Home in Philadelphia, a wonderful Catholic nun who has devoted her life to providing housing, education, medical care, and dignity to homeless people in her native city." Question number six, if you could send a note to yourself in 2030, what would it say? "Please forgive me for all the stuff I did wrong in the 2020s. I was doing my best, but life had more lessons to teach me." Question number seven, what makes you laugh? "The same thing that makes everybody else laugh, pets riding Roombas." Question number eight, what makes you cry? "Sad movies on airplanes. At times I've cried so hard the flight attendants were worried." Question number nine, what gives you hope? "The changing demographics of America. I'm praying that young people and the newest arrivals to our country will save us." Question number 10, what's your favorite place on earth? "Any long white sand beach with a cool artsy town nearby. New York's Fire Island is pretty perfect, and so is Byron Bay, Australia." Question number 11, fill in the blank. Blank is underrated. Aging. Youth is so much more painful than middle age. I wouldn't be 20 years old again for anything, not even for that nice, smooth neck. Question number 12, What would you love to invent?
A machine that turns ocean plastic into healthy plankton for whales to eat.
Question number 13. When in your life have you needed courage?
The time when I took care of Raya as she was dying. We entered our romantic relationship shortly after her cancer diagnosis, so I knew we'd have a very brief time together. But I put my entire heart on the line, and I'm so happy I did.
Question number 14. What movie could you watch on an endless loop?
The Big Lebowski.
Question number 15. If you could choose any magical power, what would it be?
Always knowing exactly the right thing to say and do. That's not too much to ask, is it?
Question number 16. If you were creating a time capsule to be opened in 100 years, what would you put inside?
A note of congratulations to humanity for still being here. Good job, guys. We weren't sure you could pull it off.
Question number 17. What is your pettiest pet peeve?
People who say nipped it in the butt instead of nipped it in the bud. In the grand scheme of things, how could this matter? But somehow I care.
Question number 18. How do you define soulmate?
Cautiously.
In the past, this term, and my eagerness to believe in it, has led me to self-abandonment, misjudgment, superinflated expectations, and heartbreak. From now on, let's just start by being friends.
Question number 19. What's the greatest gift we can give each other?
Mercy.
Question number 20. What's the greatest gift we can give ourselves?
Mercy.
It's been my pleasure to read to you this week from OprahMag.com, and I'll look forward to spending time with you again next week. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spergata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.